Well, so as a wrap-up, the think tank four. This morning, Stéphane de Wachter and I, along with Jean-Jacques Widnell, discussed a series of questions that we came up with, and we'll show you that list of questions. So these were a series of what we thought would be important topics to bring up. And at the end of this session, Stéphane and I gave presentations. The questions that we came up with, the focus of this discussion was as follows. It focused on, one, the involvement of drugs, specifically beta-3 agonists and botulinum toxin A, to the most part, and how they interact with afferents. And this discussion went on for some time, but I think we had some really interesting outcomes. So one of the things we should know is that afferent nerves are currently in focus in low urinary tract symptoms, no question, other bladder dysfunctions. And they seem to have a role in the mechanisms of action of two emerging drugs. And again, these two were botulinum toxin A and beta-3 agonists. So what we wanted to say, and we'll just reiterate it, is that of the afferent nerves that travel from the pelvic and the hypogastric nerves that enter the bladder, and that's only about 5% of the afferents, of those, 30% of the so-called A-deltas and 70% of the C-fibers. But they do go to different locations, so they have different functions. So for example, they will go, some go into serosa, some go into muscle, some go into the urothelium, and there are some that actually span it. And they'll actually go to muscle, and then they'll actually bifurcate, and they'll also go to the urothelium. And there are some differences to these. So for example, the ones that are in muscle tend to be responsive to stretch, as you would expect, but they don't really respond to stroking, for example. And those in the urothelium don't respond to stretch well, but they will respond to stroke. But they're more or less uniformly distributed. But what we based these on, first we started with botulinum toxin. The first question that came up is, where can this site of action be? Well, obviously, one would expect that preganglionically or postganglionically on parasympathetic nerves that release acetylcholine. This is thought to be the key site of action. But actually, there are other locations. For example, these nerve terminals on afferents and on the urothelium. So we've recently shown that there is, in human mucosal tissue, as well as in mouse, there is the expression of SMAP25, which is the target for botulinum toxin. So in order to study this, what we did was to use a model, and the model was the upper motor neuron lesion in the mouse. And when you do this type of lesion, you get a detrusor sphincter dyssynergia, the bladder gets bigger. And if you look at it in vivo, you get a shortening of the inner contractile interval compared to here, and reflex bladder contractions. But the unique aspect of this is, when you take it out, clearly there's a neurogenic component, but there is a myogenic component. There is this intrinsic activity that's present. And so the question becomes, what's the relevance of this to sensitization of afferents? So to look at this, first thing we wanted to show is that botulinum toxin A doesn't have any effect on the spontaneous activity. So we've injected into, for example, well, this is a control. This is just an upper lesion with no drug. And you can see the spontaneous activity. Then we've injected half bladders and whole bladders, and again, no effect. So the important point is that we and others, like Chet de Groot, have shown that this spontaneous activity can directly stimulate afferents. And so it can have a dramatic effect on afferent activity. So the question is, how do you rule out therapeutic effects? Is it working on botulinum, or is it working on a spontaneous activity? Is it working on afferents themselves? And if you put in the fetapine in these types of preps, you can show that spontaneous activity clearly goes away. I mean, it's, at the end result, it's mediated through muscle. So in order to study this, the prep that we like and the one that we used and what we base these things on is a prep where we take, and this is a mouse bladder, and we inject botulinum on just one side, one half. And we put it in with a blue dye of comparable weight. It's a blue dextran that has a similar molecular weight. And again, we do it because we found out that we can do it. You can inject through one or two sites and fill up beautifully half the bladder. Then you can put it into a bath, and so as a sheet, and one half of this will have drug, the other won't. And then you can have the associated nerves, L6, S1, S2 on either side. And these are in oil baths for recording. So the first question is, how do you differentiate whether there's an effect on afferents from whether there's an effect on efferents? So the approach that we like is as follows. So again, we'll take a bladder, and this is done in vivo. We do an injection, and 48 hours later, You can take that out as a sheet along with pelvic nerves. And then you can put tension on that prep. But then if you want to look at an efferent effect, do field stimulation. And what we see on the treated side is there's a blocking of activity. On the untreated side, we see the calcium trans-interaction potentials. Now, what if you want to differentiate and see if there's an effect on afferents? Well, in that case, what we can do is record from the afferents directly. And then if we do, Then what we can see in recording from the afferents in response to stretch is that, again, activity on this side, the treated side, is blocked, whereas on the untreated side, we see activity. So one thing we've noticed is, again, this is showing you the real data here. So this is actually optical images where we record action potentials and calcium transients. These happen to be action potentials. And if you look at the side where we stimulate untreated, we get a response. If you look on the untreated side, again, no response. So it also blocks other things. So for example, if you administer capsaicin to this preparation, what you'll do is evoke a release of activity of peptides from the nerve endings, which will cause a small muscle contraction. And on the untreated side, you'll cause a response, which you can measure here, but you don't see it on this side. So it's blocking that response as well. Again, what it doesn't block, which we showed before, is it doesn't affect spontaneous activity. There's absolutely no effect at all. So how can we determine a really defined way of looking at afferent responses? And so what we did was this approach. Again, do the injections. And then, in this case, record from pelvic nerves, not stimulate. And not using any electrical response, but in this case we use tension, where we stretch the preparation uniformly with a stepper motor. And we can see that this stretch generator, and we understand it's working on stretch sensors. There's no response in the treated side, but there is a response on the untreated side. So we'll show you the data. So here we have a control preparation. There's been no injections on it. This is an animal with a lesion. And this is control, but there's no lesion. And so one half of the bladder is untreated. The other half has been treated with botulinum toxin A. And what you can see when you give a controlled stretch is that there's some activity here. Much greater on the side where there's a lesion, so there is sensitization. But this is blocked nicely with botulinum toxin. Here it's reduced considerably. And what about the spontaneous contractions? Well, it's not blocked in and of itself, and there's very little effect from, this is so-called spontaneous activity in a control bladder, in a normal bladder from an animal. And there's very little activity, but whatever there is, it tends to block it. While on the side with a lesion, this activity is bigger, higher amplitude, gives a bigger response, and then that's knocked down considerably. But then, what's the second drug that we talked to? And what drew really good interest was the beta-3 receptor agonist. Now, the important point is, where can these beta-3 receptors be? Where can you find them? Where are they demonstrated? Well, they've been demonstrated in urothelial cells, and they may release nitric oxide, which would relax muscle. They've been demonstrated in interstitial cells. It might decrease their activity. They're certainly demonstrated in smooth muscle. We know that, and it relaxes. But they have been demonstrated on afferent nerves. So the question is, which cells are the main target if you give beta-3 agonists? Well, obviously, all could be targets, but they may work at differing concentrations. So we only have a couple more slides, but in order to try to tease this information out, what we did was to apply stretch. Now, the question with beta-3 is, if it relaxes smooth muscle and knocks down spontaneous activity, that could decrease afferent firing. So for example, here we show a controlled stretch. On top of this stretch, because it's from a lesioned animal, you see the spontaneous contraction arises. So the stretch gives a response in afferents. This spontaneous contraction gives one as well. But then in the presence of a beta-3 agonist, we get a response here, but we're not seeing a response over here. Now, you could say it's coming from that, but if we put on an antagonist, what happens is, to block that, we see that there's activity arising, suggesting, one, that we were blocking some here. But the other point is there may be some ongoing beta-3 agonism, and that we're disinhibiting that. So the conclusion from the talk, and it was robust, and it focused to a great extent on this, was that, one, both BTXA and beta-3 agonists can act on afferent nerves. That was our consensus. The effects on other cell types that are likely will contribute to a therapeutic effect. And then the exact mechanism of these actions need to be determined. And then these are the remaining questions that we have to pursue next week. Now, I must confess that we touched on many of these topics, but the focus, again, stayed very much so on the action of drugs, which is of high interest. So we'll leave it at that. And if you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer them. Okay. Yes, in the back. Stefan, come on up here.
So, Tony, the observation that there's SV2 and SNAP25 in the urothelium, that's an interesting observation. Clearly has therapeutic target implications. You know, previously we thought it was there was just SV2, SNAP25 receptor activity in the detrusor, maybe in the suburothelial layers. So, you know, this is a fundamental interest and an interesting target. So I just call that out for discussion. The second issue is just that how quickly your preps work. Within 48 hours of injecting botulinum toxin, you see an effect. That too seems to be a little sooner than perhaps many clinicians would appreciate. Certainly differs from the skeletal muscle mechanism of action of botulinum toxin. So, you know, the analog of skeletal muscle to smooth muscle seems there's some fundamental differences that need to be explored, and we can't use, there's some important questions that need to be answered. So these are good observations, and I just think they need to be called out and amplified.
Okay, well, let me address the last question first. So you're right about the onset of action. So, for example, the common wisdom is that when a synaptic vessel fuses with a wall, releases transmitter, that it exposes the target for a botulinum toxin to bind and be taken up. And if we do bath applications of drug, we see that as a response. So, for example, if you have a sheet sitting in a bath and you feel polybotulinum toxin, you can wait 72 hours and you won't see a response. The way that we evoke response is to stimulate that preparation. We give it a trains of activity repetitively, and then that action will pick up much quicker. In the mouse preparations, we see a response. We can wait longer if we wish to, but we do this again. This is done before the transection has taken place. And the idea here is that the mice void considerably more than what humans would void, and so we believe there's a much better chance for the uptake to occur. And maybe if we waited longer, we'd see a more robust response. We're not sure. But we have done some studies where we've looked at, you know, the LD50s. And in mice, it's one. That's what it's based on. If you give two units, they end up expiring. Regarding your last point, the reason that, again, when we started to do these studies, we wanted to look in humans, because there's been recent publications that suggested that there might not be SNAP25 in urothelium. It's known that there's a SNAP23 in epithelial cells. But botulinum toxin A doesn't work on that, and people have been modifying molecules to try to make it work there. But we're very comfortable with our studies that it is there. So we looked in human tissue, and we saw nice responses. And then we looked in mouse and saw it there as well. We didn't see it in rat. But without seeing it in humans, it seemed to us meaningless to pursue this, you know, effects on urothelium. And we didn't show it here, but we have done studies that suggest that there may be a response in the urothelium by inhibiting ATP, but we didn't discuss that today. Go ahead, you take that question. That's you.
No, the reason that confused me is that I assumed that the urothelial thing was secretory rather than vesicular. I mean, at least that's what I thought. So when you find that, if you find the snap, doesn't it imply that there's vesicular release in the urothelium?
Acetylcholine is not vesicular, ATP is. That's been very well established.
So that the SNAP is modulating ATP and
that's
not?
Yes. Well, when you put it in, there's a decrease in ATP release. That's been shown in isolated cell cultures by Lori Berger.
It came also from the discussion that we had this morning that the fact that the starting of the effect of the botulinum toxin could be due or could be influenced by the functional state of the nervous system. If you have a release, if you have the nerves that function quite well, like you do, you try to stimulate it, it would be something that could easily be tested also in humans to see whether the effect, because we know if we put it in, it takes a while to see the effect. If we put some kind of stimulation, whether intravesical electrical stimulation, or we give repeated bladder distension and avoiding reflex, we could try to evaluate whether this effect, this increase or the decrease in duration before it starts also occurs in humans, which could be quite beneficial in our treatment then.
One of the interesting aspects that came out with the conversation this morning was that whether it was mucosa or urothelium, and it's sort of direct, well, they're speaking at the back, so they're not listening. So the question is it, does it come from the urothelium or does it come from the mucosa? The mucosa is a far more complicated cellular material than just epithelial cells, and to an extent it's pertinent because it suggests where the targets are. So the experiments you show were Western blots, by the looks of it, of taking a mucosal preparation or a normal.
No, you're absolutely right.
I suppose what the next question is, can we sort of run this down a little bit as to where in particular?
Well, no, there are caveats, and Ann Hannah Mitchell, who works with Lori, has done some studies where they do it on cultured cells. Well, they're not cultured, they're primaries. And so they see, can't do Westerns, you can't get enough protein, but RT-PCR suggests that it is there. But you're right, and if you're going to do, and even when we do it from mouse, we have to call it mucosa for two reasons. You can't be sure it's pure urothelium, even though we scrape it. And the second, I don't want to upset Carl Eric. So, yeah.
I don't think so.
No, but it begs the question of where, you know, what would be an appropriate site of action? And again, we were talking about this earlier. Typically, botulinum toxin is given to patients with neurogenic overactivity. The idea is that if you're going to do that and it's a reflex bladder contraction, if it's, again, due to an enhanced efferent reflow, you have to block, essentially, efferent nerves. So you run the risk of putting people into retention. Now, they're casts, and so that's not a condition, not a consideration or a worry. But the truth is, if there are other sites, and again, botulinum toxin is in the bladder, it's not working centrally, it's not getting out. It would behove us to know where that site is, and that then it may be preferential to, you know, to try to focus on those sites. It may work on much lower concentrations, for example, if it's on urothelial or if it's on afferents, and if you're trying to inhibit muscle release. And so that becomes a very important issue.
Other questions?
You're surprisingly silent, Carl Eric. Okay, thank you very much.